Welcome to CKLN.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, the Canadian news is full of talk right now about Afghanistan, given the recent death of Mr. Glyn Berry, diplomat, Canadian diplomat, and also the wounding of a couple of Canadian soldiers. And, of course, Canada is set to send another 1,300 troops to participate in the NATO force and will be setting up a base in Kandahar. So to open up our conversation, what would you want to say to the people of Canada about what Canadian forces are doing there?
Well, I think at the very basic level, it must be clearly understood that the boss, if you will, in Afghanistan is the United States. You know, the real decision maker in Afghanistan is the United States. Nothing major can happen in Afghanistan unless the United States allows it to happen. And I think that should be a basis for all discussions about Afghanistan, whether you're talking about Afghan democracy or whether you're talking about Canadian troops. The NATO and Canadian troops are there because the United States has invited them in, allowed them in, essentially, you know, allowed them to do what needs to be done. And so I think that has to be the framework within which Canadians think about what their troops are doing in Afghanistan. The second most important thing, I think, is to be very clear about whether the Canadian troops and NATO troops in general are there to keep peace or not. In my opinion, it's already too late for Afghanistan. There was a window of opportunity after the Taliban had been defeated by the United States where international peacekeeping troops could have really made a difference. There was a political and military vacuum throughout the country that had it been filled by international peacekeeping troops and had war criminals been brought to trial, today Afghanistan would have really been a different country. However, the U.S. did not allow peacekeeping troops through the United Nations to come in, and instead it re-empowered old warlords who used to control the countryside, who have criminal pasts, and who have once more taken over the countryside. They are once more re-entrenched into the countryside in Afghanistan, and it's not really clear whether peacekeeping troops are going to be able to make much difference now. That window of opportunity has been lost because many of these warlords are drug lords. They are drug traffickers. Under their rule, drug sales have shot up, and that's where they get their independence, their money, their power, and the financing for their private armies. Against that, it's really it's a huge challenge for any sort of peacekeeping troops.
Well, there's a lot of ideas there. Just to start with, when Canada first sent troops in 2002, they were joining what was called at the time the International Security Assistance Force, and that was at least nominally under the control of the UN. Are you saying that it never really was, or did something happen in between?
It was under the control of the UN, but the ISAF, as you call it, International Security Assistance Force, were restricted to Kabul, which is the capital of Afghanistan. Now, this is a very small part of Afghanistan. It is the, you know, it's sort of the urban center of the country, the cosmopolitan center of the country, the focus of most of the media. But at the same time, most Afghans don't live in Kabul, yet the ISAF forces under the United Nations were restricted to Kabul. They made many calls to the U.S. to allow them to expand into the countryside. So did Afghan civil society, non-governmental organizations, and the Hamid Karzai government themselves called for an expansion of troops, of peacekeeping troops, of the ISAF troops. But the U.S. said no, it would interfere with their hunt for Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Then the United Nations turned over ISAF to NATO, essentially in order to, this happened in August 2003, and the reasoning that they gave was that, well, most of the countries, the UN countries that were doing these operations were NATO countries anyway. Logistics were getting very complicated to change over every 6 months to another country, and so it would be better if NATO, which already had experience, you know, having troops from different countries, do this. So this was the sort of rubric under which the transfer from the UN to NATO was made in August 2003, and then the U.S. said, well, we're going to now allow these ISAF troops to expand to the rest of the country, except the expansion wasn't really of peacekeeping troops. It was more within the framework of what are called provincial reconstruction teams, which is basically the military, where the military does aid work instead of actually doing military work. And that's a whole other conversation. So it used to be overseen, the peacekeeping used to be overseen by the UN and then took over by NATO. And now NATO may be representative of many countries, but it's certainly far less representative, far less accountable, far less democratic an organization than the UN. And that's taken into account all of the flaws that the UN has. But if you look at who NATO is, it's largely the wealthy white countries of the world. And their presence in a poor brown country really, I think, speaks volumes about who's really in charge and what are the implications of that.
I do want to talk about the reconstruction projects a little bit because, of course, the Canadian diplomat, Mr. Glenn Barry, who lost his life earlier this month, he was involved with those kinds of projects. I think something about finding alternate livelihoods for poppy growers. That's what was said in the press here. So can you say more about what reconstruction means in the Afghan context today?
Well, Afghanistan was promised a lot of aid right after the fall of the Taliban. There was a huge conference in Tokyo. And there was just a lot of promises and pledges made. And as the security situation unfortunately didn't stabilize, the aid promises were not fulfilled. So most of the countries that pledged aid expected the security situation to stabilize. When that didn't happen, they sort of pulled out their promises. However, the more aid that was withheld, the less stable Afghanistan became, because the less strength and power the civil society, pro-democracy groups, etc. had, you know, the less access people had to education and healthcare. And so it sort of became a vicious cycle. And so a lot of the aid that was initially pledged for Afghanistan has not come through. Much of the aid has gone to non-governmental organizations that are outside the country, that are from, you know, from the United States or based in Europe, etc. And many of them are doing very good work. For example, Doctors Without Borders was there, and, although they pulled out because the situation got too dangerous for them. But the Doctors Without Borders story is a very interesting story because it illuminates what NATO and U.S. troops are doing with respect to reconstruction. Doctors Without Borders had been in Afghanistan for 24 years, during the worst of the worst period. And a couple of years ago, five of their aid workers were killed by people who basically said they were Taliban. And the Doctors Without Borders attributed this to what they call the integration of military and aid work. So what happens is when you have military, such as the U.S., such as Canadian troops, such as NATO troops, doing things like building wells, building schools, and doing aid work, they then make life very difficult for aid workers. Aid workers are then associated with a military which has guns. However, the aid workers themselves are vulnerable because they don't have guns. But because they're then associated with the military, they become the target of disgruntled people, and they get targeted. And so Doctors Without Borders was targeted, and they left. They stopped their operation. And, of course, the Afghan people paid the price for this because Doctors Without Borders had been doing some very good work. So the Canadian troops are going in as what are called provincial reconstruction teams, which is the sort of new, you know, front for integrating military and humanitarian work, a very, very dangerous precedent. They go in, they will build a well here, a school there, for much more money than an aid organization could. And a lot of times they use the aid as a leverage, as a sort of blackmail, if you will, against villagers. So they'll find a poor village that desperately needs a health clinic, and they'll say, well, we'll build you a health clinic if you give us intelligence about the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Now, I'm not quite sure if the Canadian troops have been engaging in this, because that sort of information is not even readily available. But the U.S. provincial reconstruction team certainly had been doing that, and it's possible that the Canadian and NATO troops were also, you know, holding Afghan people hostage to intelligence gathering in exchange for aid. I mean, this is the sort of aid work. You know, they talk about winning hearts and minds, but it's really buying hearts and minds, if you will. And so it really has to be looked at with a lot of skepticism.
And can you say more about the significance of the opium production and trade in the region? I know that it's shot up by 8 times or something like that since 2001. And of course, part of the rationale that the U.S. used was, you know, that they said that they wanted to rid the area of poppy. So obviously hasn't been very effective. Can you say more about the importance of that to people's daily life and internationally?
Absolutely. A little bit of history. The situation in Afghanistan under the Taliban had been quite different from the way it is now. And even going back a little bit further, Afghanistan first became distinguished as a heroin-producing country in the 1980s when the CIA was funding this massive so-called jihad against the Soviet Union. Remember, the Soviet Union had invaded and occupied Afghanistan for 10 years, and the United States was supporting these fundamentalist parties called Mujahideen parties, and a lot of the funding that these Mujahideen began then getting was through drugs, which was a very convenient way to fund the jihad because it was money that was untraceable. There were stories of trucks that would be filled with opium that would go across the border into Pakistan. Of course, the Pakistani government was working for the U.S. government at the time. They would go to heroin labs where they would drop off the opium to be refined, and then they would get loaded up with weapons and go back across the border to Afghanistan. And this catapulted Afghanistan to the title of, you know, number one heroin-producing country in the world in the 1980s. When the Taliban came in, they took over that drug production, but the UN, through the U.S., then slapped sanctions on the Taliban. Now, they didn't slap sanctions on the Taliban's opposition, which were the Northern Alliance. The Northern Alliance were the same Mujahideen that the U.S. had backed in the 1980s. And they, too, were, of course, drug producers, as I just mentioned. The Taliban got slapped with sanctions, and under the Taliban, you had drug production actually slowly reduce. There was a pretty bad drought at the time as well, so it's not clear whether, you know, how much of the drug production being reduced was a result of the drought or the Taliban trying to follow the sanctions. In any case, you had a serious slowing down of the drug production, but only under the Taliban, which was about 80-90% of the country. In the 10% controlled by the Northern Alliance, you still had flourishing drug sales. Then when the U.S. defeated the Taliban, the Northern Alliance sort of took over the country, took over the government. Warlords were once more reentrenched into the countryside. Drug production shot up again. In many cases, the U.S. have been working with these drug lords. And this is a very, very serious situation. This drug production rivals, the money from the drug production rivals the gross domestic product of Afghanistan. What it does is it enables warlords to have complete independence, which then makes them have, you know, total impunity with respect to human rights, women's rights, any sort of rule of law. They don't have to be dependent on anything. They don't. If you slap them with sanctions, they can just thumb their noses at you because they have an independent, illegal source of funding with which to buy weapons, with which to stay in power. So it's a huge problem for these drug lords to have this sort of control. Meanwhile, of course, many ordinary Afghans, particularly poor farmers, have been forced to turn to the drug trade, either through coercion by warlords themselves who sort of control the land that they are living on, or because they've gone into debt to these warlords and then are forced to do it, or also because it's simply more lucrative than growing wheat or growing any other sort of agriculture. Afghans are so poor, you know, it is one of the poorest countries in the world today, and for rural Afghans especially, you know, who have very, very little support from the government, very few means of keeping themselves alive. A single crop of opium could feed their family for a year, and they could live quite comfortably on that. Now, for Afghans in such a situation, you can't quite expect them to give that up and then, you know, starve to death. So the U.S. has a very interesting plan. For a while, it was rumored to have been spraying these crops as they do in Latin America, but they denied it. And now USAID is in Afghanistan, and it's not quite clear whether the programs that they're instituting to try to get Afghans to give up opium growing are successful at all. On the one hand, they've been working with the drug lords. All they have to do is to start, ensuring that their own troops do not tolerate drug lords and do not condone that. In a way, perhaps it's almost too late because the U.S. has spent the last 4 or 5 years allowing these drug lords to do what they want to do. So this is a very big problem in Afghanistan. It's, I think, one of the central problems in the country, and I don't think that they have a good plan, that the U.S. and NATO have a good plan to address it.
We're speaking with Sonali Kolhatkar, the co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission, working in Los Angeles. Can you talk about the status of women in Afghanistan today?
This is a very important question, primarily because our media and the Bush administration have painted a very, very deceptive and rosy picture of women's rights today in Afghanistan. We're sold the lie that Afghan women have been liberated, that they're free, that they can go to school and have access to health care. Now, technically, it's true that women can, dress how they want to dress, go out of their houses without an escort, go to school. They can have access to health care. They can have access to employment. The trick, though, is what is happening in the practical sense. Even if they have access to these, even if it's legal for them to have access to these things, for all practical purposes, there is no health care, employment, or education, particularly in the rural areas. There are a few schools here and there. There's a few clinics here and there. But by and large, Afghan women still have among the highest maternal mortality rates in the world, among the highest infant mortality rates in the world, among the lowest literacy rates in the world. That's, of course, not going to change overnight, but because the United States has been backing fundamentalist, misogynist warlords, it may not even change in the long term. Now, Afghanistan passed a new constitution in December 2003, January 2004. In that constitution, there is a provision that gives Afghan men and women equal rights. Now, this is very progressive. It's something that even our constitution here in the United States doesn't have. But at the same time, there was a small but crucial provision that was adopted at the very last moment that said that Sharia law shall be the supreme law of the land, Islamic Sharia law. This was the same law that the Taliban were enforcing, or some perversion of it at any rate. And the men who were dominating the Loya Jirga, as it was called, the Grand Assembly where the Constitution was decided, were idealistically cut from the same cloth as the Taliban. And there were many incidents during the Loya Jirga itself where women tried to speak out. They were silenced. One young woman named Malalai Joya spoke out and denounced the warlords. Her life was threatened. Women don't have much political freedom. A lot of women have been assassinated in recent days. Women who are anchors on television have been killed. Women who dare to speak out have been threatened for being blasphemous if they dare to criticize Islamic law. And, all of the, and when I was in Afghanistan last February, women outside of Kabul seem to appear almost exactly as they did under the Taliban. They look frightened. They are not very visible on the streets. When they are visible, they cover themselves completely from head to toe, even though it's even though they're not supposed to be forced to be wearing the burqa, they still do because they're afraid or they're ashamed or they're too poor, and so they're covering their tattered clothes or some combination. There are societal taboos against walking around without the burqa, some combination of that. And of course, there's always a percentage of women who feel like they want to wear it. But by and large, most women are afraid to wear it. Women have been burning themselves to death. For example, in the western province of Herat, there have been dozens and dozens of cases of self-immolation, which was unheard of under the Taliban. There is a new chief justice in Afghanistan, Shinwari, a very fundamentalist man who has been presiding over family cases, jailing hundreds of girls for running away from their homes because they didn't want to marry the man that their parents wanted them to, or for committing adultery, etc. So women are being jailed for the most the most trivial of reasons, because they don't fit into the patriarchal system that the fundamentalist warlords want them to be fit into. It's a very, very different situation than you hear about in the media. And of course, you know, there has been some small progress made, but by and large, it's been token progress. And even the progress that has been made is likely to be turned back if the current trend towards fundamentalism, backed hugely by the U.S., continues.
Now, during the Taliban period, women's organizations like RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, and your organization were able to get some support from the feminist movement in the West for programs to assist Afghan women. I remember that. I remember it being
Certainly.
A sort of cause celeb. But what success do you have right now in bringing this message to the feminist movement in the West?
Well, let me also just say a word about the feminist movement in the West. I think while the feminist groups here really took a very important stand in speaking out against what was happening against happening to women under the Taliban, I was very disappointed with their support, and in many cases sort of overt support, and in other cases more sort of covert accepting, you know, condoning of the U.S. war against Afghanistan. In particular, there were groups that basically accepted the U.S.'s war as a means to liberate women. What that did was that trusted the U.S.'s motives, that assumed that the U.S. actually had the interests of women at heart. So I was quite disappointed that on the one hand, feminists in the West were supporting or were calling attention to the horrific treatment of women, and then on the other hand, were supporting the U.S. war, a terrible war in which thousands killed, and many are still being killed, whether it's, you know, door-to-door searches and prison abuse, etc., and also the way in which the U.S. has brought back anti-women warlords. And many of the women's groups in the West didn't listen closely enough to RAWA. Yes, RAWA was very popular at one point. They were pointed out as being this brave group of women. However, the first thing that RAWA said after the U.S. began bombing was, do not bring the Northern Alliance into power. Do not empower these men who have been, you know, proven themselves to be warlords and war criminals who have destroyed our country. Now, the feminist movement here should have taken up that cry loudly, so as loudly as they took up the cry against the Taliban. Unfortunately, they didn't, and the U.S. was able to say that they were liberating Afghan women, was able to, you know, capitalize, if you will, on the horror felt by many in the West about what the Taliban were doing, to carry out its own agenda. I was also quite disappointed by the way in which North American feminists and even European feminists objectified Afghan women through their clothing, you know, really reducing them to their burqa, not exploring the complexities of their oppression. And then once Afghan women were unveiled because the Taliban left, they were supposedly free. And people just have not been examining that more closely. And of course, I'm terribly disappointed that now, several years later, this is not a cause that's very popular. And, you know, I understand that the situation in Iraq really is demanding a lot of attention. Iraq is a horrible situation that I myself, you know, feel have taken many actions on personally and feel very strongly about. However, people have forgotten about Afghanistan. They talk about the U.S.'s war on terror as though it was happening only in Iraq. They forget, in particular women's groups, but all groups in general, forget that the U.S. started its adventures, if you will, in the so-called war on terror in Afghanistan. Afghanistan's about the same size country as Iraq. It has about the same population as Iraq. It is yet decades further back in terms of human rights, women's rights, poverty, etc., compared to Iraq. And it has decades of U.S. influence and billions of dollars of, you know, U.S. money gone into reshaping its the fabric of its country than Iraq does. Now, it's not a contest, obviously, but I just really wish that feminist groups, progressive groups, activist groups would not abandon, would not forget about Afghanistan when they do their anti-war work. it's so easy to make the connections between these two countries. There's so much to be said. The current U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, is an Afghan-American who was initially the special envoy, U.S. special envoy to Afghanistan, and then became the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. And he's doing in Iraq pretty much the same things he did in Afghanistan, which was work with the fundamentalists, legitimize them, make deals with them, and he's very, very good at that. There are many connections one can make between what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I'm disappointed by what activists have not really been doing. At Afghan Women's Mission, we had a campaign last year after we returned from our trip to try to get news coverage, better news coverage of Afghanistan, so we launched a campaign on our website encouraging people to write letters to their news organizations, various international and U.S.-based news organizations, some of the biggest ones like New York Times, et cetera. And you can send a letter, you know, from our website, AfghanWomen'sMission.org, which then goes to many of these news outlets saying, we want you to, first of all, do more coverage, and secondly, do better coverage of Afghanistan. Really give us the truth. Because the more people know what's happening in Afghanistan, the more they tend to pay attention to what's happening, the more they tend to sort of include it in their activist work, and also the more they tend to donate money to our projects, our crucial life-saving projects of health and education. We've had to close down dozens and dozens of projects since 9/11. Initially, we enjoyed a lot of financial support. We were able to keep a lot of projects going, open new ones. Now, they're all closing down because we just don't have the money. The need is still there. The need is as great as ever, but people have moved on, and it's disappointing.
So that's AfghanWomen'sMission.org?
That's right, AfghanWomen'sMission.org. There you can find information about all our different programs that we have, where we not only support the humanitarian work of Afghan women, that it's all led by Afghan women, but we support their political work, which I think is what sets this charity apart. And it is a charity. We support the work of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan that you just mentioned, because we really feel that they are at the forefront of political, pro-democracy, pro-women's rights, pro-secular change in Afghanistan. And their website, by the way, is rawa.org, R-A-W-A.org.
Now, just one last question. When we opened this discussion, you commented that Canadian troops and the other NATO troops that are in Afghanistan are basically dancing to the tune of the U.S. drum, and that the U.S. is not engaging in peacekeeping, but is acting in its own interests. What do you think are the U.S. interests in Afghanistan and in the region?
Well, see, that's a really, really good question. Now, there was a lot of noise right after 9/11, particularly on the left, that the U.S. was after oil in Afghanistan. Afghanistan lies in the heart of Central Asia, surrounded by oil and gas-rich Central Asian republics, formerly Soviet republics, such as Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, etc. It's true that these are extremely oil-rich countries that are controlled by totalitarian dictatorships, many of them. However, Afghanistan doesn't have much oil, and I actually am a bit skeptical of this sort of knee-jerk position that it's all about oil, simply because it seems clear that the U.S. was after Iraq all along. It took the Bush administration 4 days to decide not to attack Iraq after 9/11. They've always been interested in Iraq, and they realized that it would be sort of embarrassing to go straight to Iraq after 9/11 because most people were expecting the U.S. to go after Afghanistan, since there was such a direct connection between Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, and Afghanistan. Afghanistan, in my opinion, was a stepping stone to Iraq. It was also a way for the U.S. to sort of preserve its imperial credibility, its imperial prestige. You know, the most powerful country in the world had been attacked. Somebody had to pay the price. Who better than the Taliban, because they were so defenseless. Nobody would come to their defense. They were very, very weak, even though they were in control of the whole country. And as the U.S. found out, it took less than a month to actually defeat this organization, and they were quite surprised by it. And so I think, you know, someone had to be taught a lesson, and the best place to start was Afghanistan. Also, now, however, that the U.S. is there, there are definitely oil interests, and there are military interests. The U.S. now has permanent military bases in Afghanistan. It has military bases in the Central Asian republics that are sort of evolving towards permanency. The U.S. has never had military bases in this part of the world before. This is an important part of the world because it is in the backyard of Russia and China, two of the U.S.'s remaining major rivals in the world. And this, you know, certainly makes Russia and China very nervous for the U.S. to be here. And so it definitely benefits the U.S. through its adventures in Afghanistan to have a military presence. There are oil and gas pipeline interests, but most of them right now are being fulfilled between governments, such as the TAP pipeline, the Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan pipeline. The governments are benefiting directly. There has been no connection to be found between, for example, UNOCAL, which a lot of people made a big fuss about, since Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador, was a consultant to UNOCAL. There has been no evidence to show that UNOCAL has really had any benefit. And we know from Iraq that when the U.S. government, the Bush administration, wants to make money off of its conflicts and wars, it does so quite openly. Bechtel and Halliburton and all of these companies made money so openly during Iraq, it's actually not easy to find any U.S. corporations connected to the Bush administration that have been making money in Afghanistan. So I think it's been less about oil and more about sort of imperial prestige and sort of then along the way, hey, let's put some military bases here because this would be great for our future long-term goals. And I think the fact that the U.S. is reducing its troops in Afghanistan while the Europeans and Canada and NATO countries are increasing their troops also means that the U.S. is not that interested in Afghanistan. It never was. If you look in Iraq, where it really wants to be, U.S. troop size is not decreasing, and NATO troop size is not increasing. NATO had a very marginal role in Iraq because the U.S. was basically like, look, we're the boss in Iraq. We really care about Iraq. You can train a few forces in Iraq, but you can't actually be on the ground in the same way that we, you know, don't mind you being in Afghanistan. So Afghanistan was sort of a stepping stone, a pawn, if you will, in the United States war on terror effort, in my opinion.
And so many have paid a price for that.
Absolutely.
I really want to thank you for joining us and sharing your insight and your background on this very important issue.
My pleasure. And I really urge all your listeners to really not forget about Afghanistan. You know, before 9/11, it was known as the world's largest forgotten tragedy. That was the words that Amnesty International used to describe it. And I am really afraid that that's going to happen once more. And I really hope that people don't let that happen again.
Well, I'm sure your efforts are having an impact on that. And we applaud you.
Thank you.